All right, good morning. Let us begin. Today we're going to move away from the first dimension of music that we've been looking at, which is duration or time, and begin to work with the second, which is pitch and melody. And here's an initial question for you. Think of the texture of music and think of these strands of high and low. Where does melody sit in the texture? Is it high, middle, or low? Where is it? If you think about it conceptually, if you're trying to figure out, well, I got this board up here, this tapestry or whatever, where is my melody going to be in the texture? High, middle, or low? Michael? Yeah, usually high. Now here's an interesting question for you. Why is it usually high? There's an acoustical reason for this. Why does the melody show up in the high range? I beg your pardon? It's easier to hear in a high range. Why is it easier to hear in a high range? What about the acoustics here? Once again, laws of acoustics. Why is it easier to hear in a high range? I could play for you, for example, a little bit of Mozart. It would sound like this. You like that? Sounds better up there, doesn't it? Why is that the case? Yeah.
Maybe because the frequency of the higher pitches is higher, so you can detect the sound a little quicker.
That's it exactly. In a melody, we tend to have a lot of rhythmic activity there. It's got to have activity to play itself out as melody. But because the way sound waves operate, we have these low sound waves taking a very long time to clear. The higher frequencies take a lot shorter time to clear. They're short sound waves. They clear very quickly. So we can hear a melody. We can hear a melody more clearly in this higher register. And therefore, there is always the tendency to have the bass play sort of long, low notes, because those sounds take a long time to clear, and melodies play faster rhythms, because those sounds clear quickly and we can hear and enjoy the melody. All right, that's just an opening thought about why melodies show up in the top part of the texture. Let's talk about melody here and let's talk about pitch. We said before that in Western music, we have musical notation. And musical notation is relied on more in Western music than any other musical civilization around the world. And in the West, this whole idea of pitch notation goes back to the 9th century. When the monks and nuns in Benedictine abbeys in Switzerland and France and Germany, northern Italy, started doing this. They started marking on parchment or slate the general course of a melody. Eventually, what they did was to separate these lines into more discrete places or more discrete pitches. Then around 1000 in northern Italy, an enterprising fellow named Guido of Arezzo came along and said, well, you know what, I can get this to show us how far up we are supposed to go by placing it on some kind of grid here. And this is this as I say before, at the beginning of the first graph in the history of the West, this grid of horizontal lines. And we will know that if we're going from here to here, it's got to be exactly this frequency, or at least this space. So initially they came up with 4 lines, and then eventually 5, and even 6, and then they went back to 5 by the 15th century. What they also did around the year 1000 was to identify, to label these particular spots, spaces, and lines. So they began to call this A, and this B, and this C, and this D, and this E, this F, this G. When they got up here, they stopped. Why did they stop? Why didn't they keep right on going with G, H, I, J, K, L, M, and O, P? Why don't we sing M's and O's and P's today? Why did they stop? Any ideas? Roger? Yeah, they had this thing, they hit this thing called the octave. And of course, there's this another acoustical phenomenon here we've talked about before. What's the relationship within an octave? the string is vibrating, higher one is exactly twice what the lower one is. So they heard this, and they heard this is essentially all one sound. So if it's a duplication of sound, let's duplicate the letters. But you can look at manuscripts of the early 11th century and see people singing P's and L's and O's and M's and things like that. So they began to uniformly adopt this system of what's called octave duplication. And every musical culture around the world, and I've talked with ethnomusicologists about this particular point, every musical culture around the world, Chinese, Japanese, Indonesian, Indian, African, whatever, they all use this phenomenon of octave duplication in their music. But how they divide up this sonic space within the octave can vary rather considerably. Some Arabic music seems to have as many as 14 gradations within the octave. Now we're going to listen to a piece of music here from the tradition of classical India. And I thought we might have a sitar player in here. Somebody, I got wind of the fact we might have a classical Indian musician in our class, somebody that had studied a sitar and might be able to come in and play one for us. But we don't have that, so we're going to use something on our CDs by the world-famous sitarist Ravi Shankar. Okay, you've probably heard of him. He's actually quite old now. Surely he is in his 80s. He was very famous when I was in graduate school, tons and tons of years ago. But he is the venerable sitar player. And here is the pattern of the raga. We'll call it a scale. It's not really a scale, but a raga that he is using. It's got only six notes within the octave. And the six notes are... that particular pattern. Doesn't sound like any scale we've ever heard of. So let's listen to Ravi Shankar play a bit of a raga using a six-note scale. So that gives you a flavor of that, and you have that, of course, on your CD number 615. So that's a bit of sitar music. Now we're going to play another six-note scale. Let's go on to that when Linda gets set. And this, of course, is sung by Norah Jones. And as you know from reading the textbook, why do I mention Norah Jones, or why do we play Norah Jones right after Ravi Shankar? It's his daughter. Isn't that interesting? This world. Every Saturday morning, I'm going through Stop and Shop, and there's Norah Jones in the background playing. And I'm going down the pasta aisle or whatever, and I have the daughter of Ravi Shankar over my shoulder. What a world! Huh? So we're going to listen to just a couple of seconds here of a blues tune sung by Norah Jones. Here, we're not going to listen to the whole thing, is this idea of a blues scale. And so on. How's that operate? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. With this one, sometimes major and sometimes minor. We'll come back to that point. So that's another six-note scale, but a different sort of pattern, a different kind of pattern. It's a blues scale pattern. It's kind of between the major and minor that we'll talk about a little bit later on. So two different forms of a six-note pattern. Let's go to a five-note pattern. If you've ever visited parts of Indonesia, which I have not, and if you've ever visited parts of China, which I have not, I am told that you will hear this kind of music. It's played by a traditional Chinese instrument called the arhu. This I have seen around the world many times and heard. It's a two-stringed instrument that produces a particularly beautiful, vibrant tone. So we're going to listen to an arhu playing. I think this is track, if you want to pursue it, it's track 6CD, track 16. Let's listen to an arhu play a melody by a traditional Chinese composer. We call him in English Abing, and you can read about him there in your textbook. So let's pick that up. Five notes within the octave just there. So it's what we call a pentatonic scale. And that's used in a lot of Far East cultures. The pentatonic scale is the five note scale there. Okay, so we have this whole idea of octave duplication, sometimes six notes, sometimes five notes. We in the West have settled on a seven-note scale. Why did that happen? Well, we have this idea of the seven-note major and seven-note minor. Why seven notes? Well, for the answer to that, we have to go back to ancient Greek music theory. And you read about this, and it's really, really turgid stuff. But believe it or not, I teach a course on this at the graduate level. We have to read, and poor Linda has to take this kind of stuff, reading Aristoxenes and things like this. So what we are dealing here with is a situation where the ancient Greeks were very much into mathematics as a way of explaining the world and explaining music in particular. And they thought these ratios were primary. So they had the ratio of 2-1, which gave them the octave, and 3-2, which gave them the fifth, and 4-3, which gave them the fourth. They also, because the system worked out better for their purposes, then jumped to 9-8, which gave them the whole tone. So they started out there, and let's say they were working down here, they filled in the octave up above, and then they filled in the fifth, and then they filled in the fourth, and then they came down a whole step, and then they went up a fourth from that whole step, and then up a fourth from that, and they were filling in this fashion. Interestingly enough, and you ever wonder this? Sometimes somebody will wander by a keyboard and say, that's odd. What's the great oddity about the keyboard? What's strange about this keyboard? It's very asymmetrical, right? Marcus?
It's missing.
Yeah, it's missing some notes in here. There's missing something in here, and it's missing there. Well, what these are were the cracks. After the Greeks laid out their fists and fourths and whole steps, they had these little leftovers. They called them liemas. They had these little leftovers in there, and that's why we end up with these small distances between B and C. Ya-dum, ba-dum, ya-ta-ta-ta, that's a big step, ba-dum, ba-da-da-da-da-dum. That's a small step there. So the scale is actually not equal. A to B is one distance, which is a large one, and B to C is only half that distance, and that's because of the way the Greeks laid this thing out with their 2-1 ratios, 3-2 ratios, and so on. But in any event, we end up with this. Now, the Greeks had a whole series of patterns. They called them Mixolydian and Hypomixolydian and Phrygian and Hypophrygian and stuff like this. A lot of different patterns. But in the course of history, we settled, beginning in the 16th and 17th century, down into just two patterns, what we call the major pattern and the minor pattern. So let's talk about that just for a moment. And before we do it, I should add one other thing. How then do we get these other notes up here? We get these other notes up here. Well, what we now call the black notes, although historically, keyboards could be either way. You could have these added notes black or white, and then these underneath would be black. So we filled these out sort of in the 14th century. All of this got filled in. These between B and C and E and F didn't get filled in because they were already just the smallest amount that they wanted to deal with, just half steps. So we end up here within an octave, we end up with 12 equal pitches, but we still use this term a seven-note scale, because we have seven notes within the scale of the major scale and seven notes within the scale of the minor scale. All right, so let's talk about major and minor now. And we've put those patterns up here. This is D given for you in your textbook. This is something of a review. Let's start with a major scale on a C. So here is the symbol for C in the staff. Here is where C would be located on the keyboard. We're going to start here, and we have this pattern of the major that goes whole, whole, half, whole, 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 half, step. So we start on C, and then we go up to D, a whole step. Well, I'm going to write that in here. That's good. Now we go D up to E. That's another whole step. Now I have a half step. I got to go up just a half step. There I'm on E. But it's just F is just a half step away, so that's good. I don't need to do anything more than that. Now I'm on F here. Well, I need a whole step. There's my one. I need a whole step. I got to go up to G. And then another whole step up to A. And then another whole step up to B. And the last one in the major pattern is a half step from B to C. Oh, there we are. And that's good. So we've got our major scale. Let's talk a little bit about the minor scale now. It's got a different pattern. It's got a different pattern. They like melodies to go this way. They like melodies to go this way. Let's start on the same pitch, C. Let's go up a whole step. What's a whole step above C? Just D. Now we need, according to our pattern, to go up just a half step. What's a half step above D? Well, then we have to think about it. We've got to get into these black notes, which can be called sharps or flats. They're called sharps if they're up above the note in question. This would be some kind of D sharp. They're called flats if they're down below. So flats are below. Sharps take you up a half step. So we went C to D. We need this pitch here. What are we going to call it? Or are we going to call it D sharp? Well, we should call it E flat. We should call it E flat and put it up on the E line, because there's kind of a rule here that you have to use up each letter name in turn. Each letter name in turn. We can't go C, D, D sharp, F. We got to go C, D, some kind of E, F. So you got to go up the alphabet here. All right, so there we are. But is this from D to E a half step? We need a half step here. What we've written is a whole step, so we've got to indicate that this is just a half step away in that fashion, D to E flat. Now, what do we do above E flat? Well, a whole step here, where there's one half, there's another half, would take us to F. Whole step above F would take us to G. What am I going to write here from G? I need a half step here is F. It doesn't matter. Here's the pattern up here. We'll focus on this one. I need a half step above G. What's a half step above G? A flat. Okay? I need now a whole step above A flat. Nice and loud, please. Edward? B flat? Okay. And then at the end of the process, I have another whole step from B flat back to C. And that gets me back to my octave in that fashion. Okay, well, I think that's straightforward enough. If you're unsure about that, check out, of course, chapter 3 in the textbook where these issues are addressed. Okay, we've been talking about scales, these idea of major and minor scales. We said there's 7 notes in each of these 2 scales. 12 pitches altogether within the octave. But within the scale, all notes are not the same. There's one note that's the primary note, right? What's the primary note called? The note around which all the others gravitate. Tonic note, okay? Then there's one other that we have to know about. It's called the leading tone. And what it does is pull into the tonic. Let's say we're in a key of C here. The leading tone is always the 7th degree. It's always a half step, 7th degree, right below the tonic. You might say, wait a minute, I thought the tonic was down here. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. 8 is a duplication of 1. 8 and 1 are the tonic. So 7 pulls up into 8. It pulls up into 8, the tonic. That's the leading tone. Where's it want to go? You can hear it pulling in there. Opera singers love this. They love to kind of luxuriate in the opportunity to show off their voice on leading tones, build up expectation, make you wait even more for that tonic. Let's listen to Luciano Pavarotti sing a leading tone, and it's, by coincidence, happens to be the one-year anniversary of Pavarotti's death this week. So here's Luciano Pavarotti singing leading tone. The tempo here is very slow, and he slows it down even more, and then he just sits out there, this huge, wonderful voice that he had, on the leading tone. You could hear him sort of, he didn't go, yatam. He went, yatam. You could hear him slide that leading tone up into the tonic in that case. Okay, so we've got across the idea of tonics and leading tones. Did we do tonics? Do we know what a tonic is? Sing it. So given the setup, you kind of feel what you're missing, you know, what this home pitch is, the pitch to which you are gravitating. Most of our popular music, folk songs and things like that, are written in duple meter and in a major key. Occasionally you get things written in triple meter and in a minor key. That's Gershwin, Porgy and Bess in minor, folk song. Civil War song, and so on it goes. Occasionally you do run into pop pieces, folk songs in minor, but most of them are in major, probably about 80% in major. Same thing in the classical realm. Linda, what would you say? What percentage of classical pieces are written in minor keys?
Very small.
Well, give us a number. Take a...
5%.
Only 5?
Classical.
Maybe a little more than that, but not all that many. Here's, I don't know. We should do a survey sometime. Go through the literature, see what. But most, for the most part, it chose minor, major. Occasionally, minor is chosen. Here's a good example of a minor from the second movement of Beethoven's Third Symphony. Making associations with major and minor. Major, happy, bright, optimistic, a day like today. Minor, somber. Why is that the case? Is there anything in the physics of this music? No, not really. There's nothing in the laws of acoustics here that caused that to be the case. If you look back over it, there was no prejudice major or minor in Western music up in about the 16th century. And then people started writing these things called madrigals that were tied to texts. And they got in this habit of every time they had a bright, happy text, they'd set this in one kind of mode or key, a major mode. And every time they had a sad one, they'd set it in minor. We got used to hearing it that way. So it's kind of every time, you know, Schumann wants to write about the Merry Farmer. But every time Chopin wants to write a funeral march, there's a tendency also minor, low, major, high kind of thing. So we get used to this. And this point that it is culture rather than acoustics was brought home to me once in a discussion with a student here at Yale who said to me, yeah, but over there at the Schliffka Center, we Jews have lots of happy melodies, and they are all in minor, what you would call minor. And so I thought about that. Yeah, that's probably true. Even the... Isn't that the Israeli national anthem? I think so. Is that right? What is that? What? Yes or no?
Yeah.
Okay. But it may be. How many national anthems around the world do we have in minor keys? What does this say about the tradition of Jewish music? Is it really Western, or is it Eastern European, or Asian, even with some Asian influences? Interesting issues. Issues that can be brought home, this kind of ambiguity sometimes you encounter in klezmer music. What's klezmer music? Sort of Jewish, traditional Jewish folk music, a lot of it coming out of Eastern Europe. So we're going to listen to a kind of souped up or rocked up version of some klezmer music here, and what they have a strong bass, electric bass underneath. And we're going to listen to a minor melody with a leading tone thrown in that gives it this kind of exotic feel. And then it will switch to major. So let's listen to this bit of klezmer music go back and forth between minor and major. So that's the intro. Now we're going to go on to the shift to major here, another little clip. So there it's in major. Let's listen a little bit more. It's going to go back to minor and then I think shift back to major. We'll be able to hear the shift. Turn it down just a little bit, Linda, please. Major or minor? Raise your left hand if you think it's minor. What about this? Major or minor? Right hand if it's major, left if it's minor. This is major. Okay. All right, so that's a little bit of this ambiguity between major and minor in a piece of traditional Jewish music. Let's see. Let's talk about hearing, how we hear these melodies. The reason that we hear these is as distinctly different, I think, happens rather early on in the scale. Let's think about this for a minute. We've got this scale up here. Ya ta ta. If you go over to this scale, ya ta ta. Does that sound dark? I don't know. 500 years ago, that wouldn't have sounded dark. Now that sounds dark to us, Ahmed. Ya-ta-tam, ya-ta-tam. But that darkness occurs very early in the scale, as you can see there. It's the third note. And we'll be talking about the fact that this is an interval of the third. It spans three letter names a little bit later on. So that minor third can show up very early in the scale. That's a critical moment in any scale, determining how we're going to feel about it. And we can just play with that particular interval to change entirely the way we feel about particular melodies. Here is a Christian song. I guess it's, right? Joy to the world, the Lord has come. Don't we sing as a Christmas carol, or some people sing as a Christmas carol? Not much joy there, huh? You like that one? How about... My favorite is, you know, know, you can turn this whole thing. You're in a Jewish bar mitzvah, something like that. And you were singing with the Coen brothers down somewhere in, you know, in Appalachia. What was that wonderful movie that had the Coen brothers and all that great American folk music in it? You Are My Sunshine. Brother, Where Art Thou? Wasn't that what it was called? Brother, Where Art Thou? Yeah. So just that little switch, turn of a switch there. You can do some great things with changing the mode. So we've got scales that are in the major mode. We've got scales in the minor mode. We also have scales in the chromatic mode. And that's when we don't have just seven pitches within the scale. We're going to use all of the pitches, all 12 here. Chroma from the is the Greek word for color. So this is a more colorful scale. What does it do for us? Well, that's a chromatic scale. We had an example of that the other day working with the Mozart. Where was that? In the Requiem. Oh, fooey. Yeah, remember he was coming up a minor scale? And then he, at the top of it, switched over into a chromatic scale. Here's the score. Minor, now chromatic. What does this do to us? Why did he do that? Well, chromaticism adds tension to music, and especially chromaticism that's pulling up. Scales that go up add tension. Music goes up generally adds tension. But if you can double that, combine that with chromatic music, then you've got a sort of super whammy of tension, and that's what he's doing there, trying to build tension as the just rise from the graves at that particular point. Entire compositions are rarely written in the chromatic scale. Yeah, it's kind of a color that you throw in from time to time for a special effect. So we've got the major and minor scales, we've got the chromatic scales, we also have what we call conjunct melodies. Melodies are just kind of running up and down the scale in neighboring tones. Those are two Christmas carols that are very conjunct in nature. A good example, we used it a moment ago, of a disjunct melody is... Can we all sing that? Here we go. Ready, sing. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the park, etc. It's amazing that that melody has become as popular as it has, given the fact that it's really hard to sing. It's a very disjunct melody. It's got all these odd leaps. Ya, beep, beep, bop, boop, 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 beep. Sounds like Schoenberg, almost. It's sort of off the map here in terms of disjunctness. But nonetheless, we have been able to absorb all of that. So melodies can be conjunct or disjunct. And possibly the most conjunct of all melodies in the history of music was the melody that we looked at very briefly in the first gathering, and that is Beethoven's famous Ode to Joy. Now, Ludwig van Beethoven was in his 50s when he was working on his last symphony, what proved to be his last symphony, his ninth symphony. And he'd been tinkering with this particular melody all the way back to probably 1803, so it's about 20 years or so. Ninth Symphony is 1823-24. As early as 1823, we know he's working on trying to get this to work just right. And eventually, over this 20-year period, he did get it to work just right. Let me swing this board around. Here's the famous melody. I've put it in the key, what's called the bass clef here, and it's in a major key. We don't need to know what the particular notes are, but let's look at this just for a moment, because it works well as a prototype of melody. It does something that a lot of melodies do. First of all, as you can see by the trajectory here, it's very conjunct, right? All neighboring notes here. If you look at the German in the text, it has to do with zwei umschlungen Millionen, the millions be embraced. And this, I believe, is the sort of national anthem for the United Nations. So this has to be something that we can all sing. And if you have conjunct motion, that makes it easier. It's also very symmetrical. As you can see, it's nothing but a pattern of four bars plus four bars plus four bars plus four bars. And as we said before, music has a syntax, so that these phrases have to be in a arranged in a particular way that makes sense. So we start here out here with an opening phrase. Ya ta 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 ti ta 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 ta. Is that the tonic da da? Can anybody sing the tonic? Yeah. Dum. The tonic is actually over here. It's a little bit lower than that. That was a really hard question. I'm amazed that anybody got it. Good few. So what happens here is this opening phrase that we'll call A. Musicians like to label stuff just with alphabetical labels to keep it simple. We'll call this phrase A. It sort of opens things up. And we refer to this as the antecedent phrase. The next phrase, B, la da 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 da, is very similar, da 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 da, but here it takes a deviation, da ta tum, and gets us back to the tonic. Now we could walk out the door at that point, right? Da da, we're feeling tonally stable there. We've got it all together for the rest of the day. However, it'd be a pretty short melody. So what he then does is write an extension. We'll call this C. Ya ta 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 ta. Ah, very interesting. Put an asterisk by this. Beethoven, in a way, saved this melody. He rescued this melody, which was in danger of becoming excessively four-square by doing what? If I had been writing this, da ta 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 ta. Da, 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 da. What did Beethoven do here? We talked about it last time, a rhythmic device. Syncopation. He brings his opening note, that F sharp, in a beat early. This should, you would think, be a half note, and this would start on the downbeat over here. But he brings, in effect, the sound of the downbeat in a beat early. Gives a little bit of pep there at that particular point. And then, what is this here? La. Well, of course, it's a replication of B. We've got to end on the tonic. All pieces, classical or pop, one way or the other, end on the tonic. Okay, so let's have us now, I'm going to put a fermata over this. Let's all sing this. I think we don't have to read the notes. You don't have to sing any text, we're just going to sing la. I'll conduct in four, so sit back, ba ma 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 ha 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 ha. Everybody vocally prepared here? Here we go. I'll give you one, two, ready, sing. La 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 la, louder, louder, la 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 la, la la la, good. La 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 la. We'll put a big retard on it there. So we wanted to bang that syncopation, and then of course there's no sound on the downbeat over here to make the syncopation work. So that's the melody. Seems very simple, but it took Beethoven a long time to sort of iron all this out, make this perfect melody, the prototypical melody in a way. And then in the early 1820s, he decided to incorporate this as the main theme of the last movement, the finale of his last symphony. So this is some of the last music that Beethoven wrote in the setting that we're about to listen to. So let's listen. We're not going to, I think Linda has it set here. We're going to hear the beginning of this, and he presents this as a series of variations. So here is the first presentation of our melody. Nice and loud. That's okay. he repeats C and B. Okay, now let's pause it there. Let's pause it right there. Now, we're going to go on to the second presentation of the theme, and I have three questions for you as we do so. Where has the theme, the melody, gone here? Is this a motive or a theme, by the way? Theme. It's not a motive. It's way too long. It's a good example of a theme. It's way too long for a motive. Motive would only go about 4, 5, 6 notes. So we have this beautiful theme here, and as we listen to this next presentation, where has the theme or melody gone? What instruments are playing it now? What is the texture like? How many lines can you hear in this texture? How many strands of music do you hear? Can you pick up? And thirdly, what is this texture called? Last time we said we had three kinds of texture in music, which are monophonic, homophonic, and polyphonic. Which is this particular texture? Okay, here we go. Linda, let's go, but we should have a previous, yeah. It should be, but that's the next variation. I confused Linda there. Here. So what do you think? How many lines? First of all, where's the melody gone, the theme? It's gone up a little bit, and it's being played by what instruments? Yeah, strings, violins, but not the top part of the violin family, kind of second violin, middle range of the strings here. How many parts do you hear in the, how many separate musical lines there? Marcus? Three. Tell us about those three. We've just talked about one of them, the melody and the violins up above. Can you tell us about some of the others?
They're
doing like a counterpoint. Right. They're doing, yeah. Okay. This is, it's too easy. I'm sorry. I had to go for that one. They are playing a contrapuntal line, but you're absolutely right. That's the key point, and that then answers, Marcos, what's the texture? If you've got Marcos, please? Yeah, polyphonic. So this is polyphony here. What was the third voice? If we had melody up above and kind of a counterpoint, as Marcos says there, in the middle, what was the, we had one other part, and what was that? Well, let's listen a little more. We've identified the melody. Can we just continue from where we are? Okay. Maybe you jumped ahead, as I told you to do. It's my fault, not yours. So we're going to back it up into that previous variation. Let's just see if we can pick up what the missing third part here. It's a bassoon playing the contrapuntal line. So what is the third part there? The bass, yeah. Usually you're going to have a melody and you're going to have a bass. So the bass is doing stuff. So there's the melody up above, this bassoon playing the counterpoint kind of in the middle, and then the bass playing these notes quietly underneath. It's a little bit hard to hear. I think we have time. Let's just continue right from there a little bit more. Can you hear the bass now? There's the bassoon counterpoint. Okay, and let's listen to just a little, we're gonna pause it there. Now let's listen to, must be, what, the third presentation here of the theme. Where is the theme now? Now, how many parts are there in the texture? It right there. What about that? Well, it's a little bit hard to tell exactly, isn't it? Hard to tell. What could you say for sure about it? You got a melody, and where's it gone now? Oh, it's gone up. It's all now in the first violins. What else is in there? A bass. Yeah, we got a bass. And now we, what else? Some other stuff in the middle. Right? And that may be about as much as we can do with that. I mean, really, myself included. I could sort of sit there and try to track lines, but I'd have to repeat it. So I think if we said, we got melody, we got theme, we got bass, we got a bunch of other stuff in the middle, that's just fine and dandy. But the idea that they're all kind of independent points out once again that they are playing polyphonic texture. Let's listen to the end of the polyphonic texture. Then Beethoven, and we'll stop with this. Beethoven was like a military general. Interesting the way he operated. He's setting up these battles. And indeed, he wrote something called a battle symphony. And you can just see him, how he's kind of marshaling particular forces to do particular things at particular time. So he kind of held back here the heavy artillery. The heavy artillery in the orchestra is what? The brass and sometimes percussion. So it's the brass he's going to bring in at this point. So we'll listen to the end of the third presentation of this with the contrapuntal idea dominated by strings, melody, bass, other stuff in the middle, and then he will bring in the brass for the final statement of this. And I think our time is about up, so we'll listen to this and you can kind of go out as we hear the fourth statement of this.
Thank you.